Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble, on the Thursday edition of The Cross in the Desert. Got an urgent prayer request for all of my listeners this morning. It concerns Asiya Bibi languishing in prison in Pakistan. She's on death row. Her health is severely deteriorated to where she is suffering from intestinal bleeding, vomiting blood, and constant chest pains. She has been there since June of 2009, when she was accused, according to the Pakistani blasphemy law, of insulting Muhammad. But this was all a result of her drinking from a water cup from her Muslim co-workers. This is a very serious situation. Back and forth appeals, no mercy for this beautiful Christian lady, and we need to really come together and pray for God's intervention and grace and healing in this situation. It's the only way that she is going to make it through this ordeal. Please remember Asiya Bibi today in your prayers. Well, June 30th has come and passed, and today is the 2nd of July. We are in another extension of the nuclear talks, and continually I think of Nagme and Sarah Hamati, and it's just a very, very frustrating, difficult situation. Saeed and Nagme's anniversary, believe it or not, was this past June 30th, which was the official deadline to the nuclear talks. And what I wanted to do this morning, before I do anything else, I want you to hear this amazing letter that Nagme wrote to Saeed in prison. And I'm going to read it word for word because it's just incredible. I want you to hear this. For everyone following the imprisonment of my husband, Saeb Abedini, June 30th marks the looming deadline of when the United States was supposed to conclude the lengthy negotiations with Iran on its nuclear development. Since the deadline was set in April, June 30th has signified a potential turning point for whether the United States would secure Saeb's release before walking away from the negotiating table. Yesterday, news broke that the June 30th deadline would come and go and the talks would be extended for an unspecified number of days. The extension signifies an extended opportunity for our government to arrange Saeed's release, an opportunity I pray our government will not take lightly or let slip through the cracks. Meanwhile, our family waits without any word on the status of these efforts. For Saeed and me, June 30th has not always been about such weighty political entanglements. Instead, June 30th was full of the glorious memories we had of entering into the covenant of marriage with each other on June 30th, 2004. As we spend this 11th anniversary apart, I decided to share with our supporters the letter I wrote for my husband. To my dearest Saeed, on our 11th year anniversary. Every year on our anniversary, I would think of what is the best gift that I could give you. Since you have been imprisoned in Iran, the process has gotten that much harder. What do you give a prisoner who is thousands of miles away? There is so much I want to give you. Good food, clean water, fresh air. I want to be there to nurse you back to health, to give you a hug, a touch, to give you your freedom, things I cannot give you. The Bible says to remember those in prison as if we are in prison with them and to feel your pain as if in our own bodies. For 1,007 days, I have remembered you in prayer and felt your pain. For 1,007 days, I have been in prison with you as your wife and soulmate. Each night I have struggled with anxiety and a sense of urgency that we need to get you out. Each night that I have laid my head on our bed, I have hugged your empty spot and have wept myself to sleep. Each morning I have woken up with an excruciating pain to my new reality without you. I have prayed. Oh, how I have prayed. I want you to know that since your imprisonment, I have held prayer vigils every year as an anniversary gift to you, to let you know that you are not forgotten, that your wife and the body of Christ are standing with you as you stand for your faith in Jesus. This year, we're doing another one on September 26th to mark the 3 years of your imprisonment. This year, as my gift to you, the focus will not just be praying for you and the persecuted church, but also for something that is dear to your heart, something that you have mentioned in your recent letter and something that you have mentioned in each prison visit, something that you are praying for daily. This year, we are also praying for revival in America. Saeed, your wife wants you to know that you are not forgotten. You are covered in prayer. Your wife and the body of Christ are standing with you. We are giving you what prison walls cannot take away. We are giving you our prayers. Your loving wife, Nagme. Quote, I am grateful that unlike ordinary news stories that fade away quickly behind tomorrow's headlines, Saeed's suffering is never far from the hearts and minds of his brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. Thank you for hearing my heart for prayer and sharing in this anniversary with me. What do you say to that incredible letter? Words really fail me. A wife that is so dedicated and has spent 3 or more years without her husband on anniversaries, on birthdays, Christmas, special occasions, and is still strong in the Lord, still fighting for him. What a dedicated wife. I'm just in awe of Nagme's faith. We're going to go a little bit behind the scenes now about the extension for the nuclear deal. I want you to hear the latest news right now on the cross in the desert.
Well, I think the clue to that seven-day extension came earlier in the day when the Iranian foreign minister returned from consultations in Tehran. Little more than 24 hours had been away from Vienna here. When he returned, he went into a meeting with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. That meeting lasted about an hour and 45 minutes. A lot of it a one-on-one, face-to-face between Kerry and Zarif. Zarif saying at that meeting that he believed a deal could be done. But before he went into that meeting, he did lay down some conditions for how the agreement and how things should proceed from here. He said any agreement should be fair and balanced.
The only agreement that can last and also be acceptable to the Iranian nation is one that is balanced and one that is fair. And I believe that the opposite parties have understood this, that without a good agreement and without the recognition of the rights of the Iranian nation, we will not be able to reach a lasting agreement.
Well, senior U.S. State Department officials had also been saying that they believed a deal can be done. However, they say the parameters for that have to be based on the Lucerne Agreement made in Switzerland about 3 months ago. But they say that they think that they can see a way, a path to get an agreement. The question at the moment is, now the path that the Iranians imagine and the path that the State Department imagine, are these paths going to converge? The seven additional days certainly gives time to work out some of those details. We saw Zarif today also meeting with the head of the International Nuclear Watchdog, the head of the IAEA. Perhaps they're getting to talk about some of the details, how the inspection process might work, which has become quite a contentious issue. Access potentially to military sites has become very contentious over the past week or so. So perhaps beginning to hammer out some of the finer details on that. Also, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, spent almost 2 hours with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry. Some of that meeting devoted to wider issues other than these talks. But it does seem at the moment the fact that an additional 7 days has been given now, the hope that an agreement can still yet be hammered out. Nick Robertson, CNN, Vienna, Austria.
Please have a seat. The goal of the nuclear negotiations is not to rely on trust, but to set up a verifiable mechanism where we are cutting off the pathways for Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. The framework agreement that was established at Lausanne is one that, if implemented effectively and codified properly, would in fact achieve my goal, which is Iran not obtaining a nuclear weapon. There has been a lot of talk on the other side from the Iranian negotiators about whether in fact they can abide by some of the terms that came up in Lausanne. If they cannot, that's going to be a problem. Because I've said from the start, I will walk away from the negotiations if in fact it's a bad deal. There's still some hard negotiations to take place, but ultimately this is going to be up to the Iranians to determine whether or not they meet the requirements that the international community has set forth to be able to fairly and accurately and consistently assess whether or not they have foreclosed the possibility of obtaining a nuclear weapon. And given past behavior...
President Obama, this has been, it's not going to be, this has been a bad deal from the very beginning. How dare we sit down across the table from the number one state sponsor of terrorism in the world and negotiate? There is no negotiations. We simply stop the process. We demand Saeed and Amir and the journalists and Levinson's return. We demand it. We don't ask it. We don't try to persuade it. We make this the precondition. And this is not a vacillating thing. You hear the words of our president who says he claims he will walk away from this so-called bad deal. We should have walked away from the very beginning and not allowed Iran to dictate this entire process. It is going on simply because we have caved to them. We have not been adamant with them. We have not confronted their behavior in the world. We allow them to continue to hurt, to harm, to persecute, to just commit the most egregious human rights violations against their own people. It has gone unchecked, unconfronted. This has been a bad deal from the beginning, just like Benjamin Netanyahu said several months ago when he had his speech in Congress. This is a shame. This is a shame that our American citizens languish in prison while we continue to extend deadlines, while we continue to negotiate, while they continue to up their Iranian enrichment, while they continue to say there will be no verifications, there will be no checks, there will be no inspections. You can't talk to our scientists. Who is dictating the process? This is a very bad deal from the beginning. Just a few days ago, Lisa Daftari from Fox News wrote a very important op-ed piece on this whole negotiation process and reflecting 6 years ago to the election violence and the protests in the streets of Iran. It's called Iran's 2009 Green Revolution, Michael Jackson and the Upcoming Iran Deal. I want to read this to you. It's really worthy for you to hear this. 6 years ago, today, round-the-clock coverage of Iran's Green Revolution came to what is common practice in today's media world, a complete halt upon the breaking news that Michael Jackson had died. Up until those moments, the people of Iran, taking it upon themselves to become brave citizen journalists in a censored and suffocated political environment, posted updates and vivid videos on social media sites, had the support of Western media, who curiously accepted the invitation of savvy and pro-West Iranians to introduce them to the world. We all felt like we were on the chaotic yet spirited streets of Tehran. And to anyone who had been following the modern history of Iran, particularly since the fall of the Shah, in 1979 and the mullahs rise to power, this was the most opportune moment to effect real, significant social and political change in Iran. The Iranian people would win. The region would win. The U.S. would win. But that moment was lost, and perhaps now, as we sit only 5 days away from the potentially striking a deal with a regime that has only become increasingly brazen in 6 years' time, it's clear that the White House strategy was to favor diplomacy with a charlatan partner over supporting a grassroots movement regime change for 75 million. A popular chant among the protesters on the streets of Iran was, quote, Obama, are you with them or with us? And at that moment, despite a cogent letter by five former Obama advisors, bipartisan agreement among the American lawmakers in the House and the Senate, stern warnings from our allies in the Gulf states, it still appears that President Barack Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry will push forward for a deal. At the end of March, on the eve of the previous nuclear negotiation deadline, I wrote, the barbaric crimes against the women, the youth, journalists, dancers, musicians, Christians, Baha'is, and others will go on without a mention under current negotiations with the West, as will the incarceration of three American citizens, Pastor Saeed Abedini, Marine Amir Hekmati, and Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, as well as possible information about CIA operative Robert Levinson. Talks also leave out any preconditions about the Iranian regime's activities and support of terrorism in the region, including backing the Houthi rebels in Yemen, propping the Assad regime in Syria, providing financial and other support for Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza, their presence in Latin America and elsewhere. Not much has changed in gaining the trust of the Iranian regime since the last deadline, or the one before, or even before that. The regime continues its barbaric practices at home against its people in the region, building terror networks and instability, and sadly, no sign of release for the American prisoners. And if the argument is that the deal only focuses on curbing the Iranian regime's nuclear program, well, sadly, we're not getting much in terms of that either. Iran's government is doing everything in its power to ban nuclear inspectors' access to any military sites, and they have already announced that nuclear scientists cannot talk to the press. And the most inconvenient fact of all, a little over 3 weeks ago, international inspectors announced that Iran's stockpile of uranium fuel had increased about 20% in the last year and a half of negotiations, completely undermining President Obama and Secretary Kerry's narrative that their program has been frozen. Since the interim deal was announced at the beginning of April, the government in Tehran has proven to the world what its people were trying to convey in 2009. They cannot be trusted. Excellent article from Lisa Daftari about the ongoing disaster deal that we are sitting across the table. Nagmeh has mentioned several times in the last week that we should call the White House, email the White House, email the State Department, call them as well, and I've listed those numbers on my page. We should continue to do that. With this 7-day extension, we should continue to bombard the different numbers that she has given us to call, emails. Everything we do is one step in the right direction of securing Saeed and Amir's release. We need to continue doing that and praying as well. So I hope these articles, what I've been reading and sharing with you, has helped you, has motivated you to not give up. This is just an ongoing, frustrating process, and we need to continue to do our part of speaking out and praying for their release. Just a few years ago, there was a significant film called Iranium, which outlined this whole nuclear program that Iran is engaging in. And one of the people that appeared in the film was Claire Lopez, and she had some insights then, just a few years ago, about what we're dealing with today. And I want to play this interview for you right now on The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen.
It is the policy of the Iranian government to attack and kill Americans wherever and whenever they possibly can. This is playing out in Iraq through the preferred method used by the Iranian government, which is through proxies. And so we see them using Shiite, Sunni militias, terror militias inside of Iraq to do the attacks specifically. But they are trained by the IRGC and the Quds Force. They are trained by Hezbollah, another terror proxy of Iran. Towards the end of the 1980s war between Iran and Iraq, Iran's military leadership knew that it was losing the war, and it went to Ayatollah Khomeini and said, "We're not winning this thing." Khomeini said, "Get me a bomb." Khomeini ordered his commanders of the IRGC to get an atomic weapon, is what he called it at that time. And from that point forward, the IRGC has been in control of the development of Iran's nuclear weapons program. As a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran comes under the authority of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And as such, they are obligated to disclose all of their nuclear development sites. The fact that they have not done so and did not do so for the entire length of their nuclear weapons program is testament to the duplicity with which Iran has dealt with the international community. This is a regime which repeatedly has threatened the State of Israel, its United Nations fellow member, with genocide, with wiping Israel off the face of the map. This is a regime whose constitution commits it to the export of revolution and jihad throughout the world. This is a regime which has supported terrorism and terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah since the beginning of the regime, 30-some years ago now. This is a regime which has coordinated with terrorist organizations, Hezbollah, with Al-Qaeda, to mount attacks not just against the United States, but other members of the United Nations, of other countries across the world. This is a regime which oppresses, savagely oppresses, its own people inside its own borders. So a regime like this, to get a deliverable nuclear weapon, is a serious danger. It is an existential danger to Israel. It is a national security danger for the United States of America. To allow Iran to to become a nuclear weapons power without stopping it will be to the detriment of American national security as well as Israel.
From the film Iranium, that is Claire Lopez. She is right on target. This was some 4 years ago. I played this purposely. Number one, because it's a great film. It really documents how the Ayatollah Khomeini asked for a nuclear weapon and actually put together the process that we are living with today. And that has been over 35 years ago. This is Claire Lopez from about 4 years ago saying what we have been saying now in the last 2 years since the negotiations have begun. And yet we are still talking with them. A very, very sad situation. Please continue to pray for Saeed, for Amir. Please continue to make your phone calls and your emails. By God's grace, we will win in the end. We will triumph over this very, very deplorable situation. I want to remind us also, we are following the 30 days of prayer for the Muslim world. And actually, we have reached the halfway point in the Ramadan holiday that Muslims are participating with all over the world. Our prayer theme today for day 15 is praying for Turkestan. It's a land of 200 million Turkish people, comprising 227 Turkic people and 15 nation. It really stretches 4,000 miles across the steppes of Central Asia, ethnic origins in the Altai Mountains on Mongolia's western border through the turbulent Caucasus region before it spills into modern-day Turkey and the Balkan states of Europe. And so this is our focus today. Turkestan, total population, wow, 203,251,000 people, just a lot of people in that region alone. Pray for the persecuted Muslim background believers in the churches of Turkestan. Pray that the current oppression of Christian missions to Turkestan would lead local Turkestani Muslim background believers to evangelize more boldly. Pray for the thousands of Turkestani villages that have no gospel witness whatsoever. This is our opportunity to show our perfect love by praying for Muslims all over the world. Please join me. There's 15 more days that we can speak truth and pray for a revelation of God's grace, a revelation of who He is to Muslims all over the world. It is such an honor to pray for my Muslim friends as well. What I want to do now is switch gears just for a couple of minutes. I want to go back to the Supreme Court decision for gay marriage. My wife, Becky, was on the last broadcast really, really explaining this whole process about how the Supreme Court really bypassed the vote of the people and instead voted on this issue from the 14th Amendment for the sake of dignity, that they bypassed the 10th Amendment that gives states rights to vote on this issue and to not have it imposed on them. What I want to do is bring to you a short interview with Senator Ted Cruz, who's running for president in 2016. As he was on the Kelly File just a couple of nights ago, he had some very important insights for this issue. Let's listen.
Public opinion rather than the Constitution. Joining me now, Texas Senator and Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz. His book, A Time for Truth, hit stores today. Senator, good to see you. Okay, so let's start with that plan for the U.S. Supreme Court. I know you're unhappy with the decisions, but, yeah. But, Alexander Hamilton, the complete independence of the courts is peculiarly essential in a limited constitution. Now you want to rewrite the Constitution in response to a couple of decisions you don't like?
Well, Megan, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me. And last week's decisions were the latest in a long line and sadly were the nadir of the Supreme Court. It was a majority of the justices on Thursday rewriting Obamacare, disregarding the law, forcing that failed law on millions of Americans, hurting millions of Americans. And then on Friday, the marriage decision was utterly contrary to the Constitution. They're simply making it up. And as Justice Scalia powerfully said in dissent, that decision was an assault on our democracy. It was five unelected lawyers setting themselves up, and these are Scalia's words, as the rulers of all 320 million Americans.
I get that, but in response to a decision that you feel was politically motivated by the justices who are in the majority, you want to make the court more political?
It's pure politics. And you know, the framers, when they wrote the Constitution, they believed the check on judicial overreach. The framers wrote about judicial overreach quite a bit. They believed the check would be impeachment. Now, here's the sad reality. Within a few decades, Thomas Jefferson said impeachment had become not even a scarecrow. Even 200 years ago, the Supreme Court wasn't afraid of it. Today, we have a United States Senate. We can't even muster 50 votes to defeat Loretta Lynch, an attorney general who tells us she's not going to follow the law or the Constitution. There's no universe in which there are 67 votes to remove Anthony Kennedy from the Supreme Court.
How would an electorate that twice elected Barack Obama create a court that you like better than the one we have now?
Well, let's be clear. What I'm talking about are judicial retention elections, which means you'd have the same appointment, the same Senate confirmation. But every 8 years, the people would have an up or down vote with the option to remove a justice.
What if the people bounced out Scalia and Alito and Thomas, and we had a President Obama in the White House?
Well, I can tell you that 20 states have put in place judicial retention elections, and they have worked. The people have used them sparingly. But the alternative is, who in their right mind would design a system where every major public policy issue of the day is decided not by the people, not by the Constitution, not by elected representatives, but by 9 elite lawyers in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. As Justice Scalia observed in dissent, all 9 of them, they either graduated from Harvard or Yale. The 8 of the 9 are from the East Coast or the West Coast. Yes, I graduated from Harvard, too. As you know, my dad refers to my time up there as missionary work. I think the problem was that I didn't learn what they wanted me to learn there. I was a little too thick-headed to be indoctrinated when I was up there.
Well, you work for
I just wanted to bring you those brief comments from Ted Cruz. What a strike against democracy with these the 5-4 decision, these 5 elite black-robed men who did not vote according to the Constitution or democracy. And so we will keep focused on this issue, because what it means is that churches may be in danger in the near future with their tax-exempt status if they refuse to marry gay couples. And so we're going to monitor this situation very, very carefully. I want to talk about an issue right now that is near and dear to my heart, and that is the issue of human rights, honor killings, and the situation about how women are so violently treated in the Muslim-majority countries. Just 7 years ago, a horrible tragedy occurred in Texas when the lives of Amina and Sarah Saeed were taken so viciously and violently by their father, Yusef. He was a taxi cab driver. He disagreed with their Americanized, Westernized viewpoints, and because of that, he tragically shot and killed them in his taxi cab. Since then, he's been on the run, still escaping the scrutiny of the FBI. And there has been a major documentary film that has been created to share their stories with the world and the whole idea of honor killings. My good friend Zainab Khan is going to sit on the panel that is bringing this movie to Chicago on July 9th. And I have talked to Zainab. I said, you just got to come on and share your insights from that screening of this incredible film, The Price of Honor. It's going to happen July 9th. And I know that she's a real busy lady. And she has assured me that as soon as it's all over, we will get together and she will share here on The Cross in the Desert her insights about this new documentary film, and also share about what is happening in the arena of human rights against honor killings and things related to that. What I want to do right now, I want to take us back to when The Price of Honor first premiered in the theaters in special screenings back in October, and let's talk about this amazing, amazing new film, On the Cross in the Desert.
Best of two North Texas teens that made headlines in 2008 are now the center of a new documentary airing for the first time tonight in Dallas. The Price of Honor highlights the tragedy of honor killings in the United States. It also reveals new information about the murders of Amina and Sarah Saeed. NBC5's Jocelyn Lockwood joins us live in Dallas. So what was the reaction tonight, Jocelyn?
Amanda, it was an emotional one for sure. More than 200 people turned out to watch The Price of Honor here at Lakewood Theater in Dallas. Friends, a former boyfriend, even members of a shattered family watch the horror they once lived through play out on the screen.
very devastating.
More than 6 years after the double murder of sisters 18-year-old Amina and 17-year-old Sarah Saeed,
I can't imagine what their life was like.
The Price of Honor.
It was just me. It was abusive too.
Made its debut. It's a nightmare. The girl's great aunt now lives.
And to see them at that age again, you know, and the pain. It brings it back to me.
New Year's Day, 2008, the girls were found shot inside a taxi in Irving.
They wanted freedom, you know, the freedom that you and I have always enjoyed and taken for granted. These girls could not do that.
Their father, Yasser Saeed, has not been seen since, but is suspected of killing his daughters. The film alleges because he disapproved of their American lifestyle.
I really do hope that this will be the catalyst that will bring justice for these two girls. They did not bring dishonor upon their family name. Their dad did that.
Producers firmly believe more had to be done to bring this dark story to light.
On Amina's Facebook page, MySpace page, right before she passed away, she wrote, made a comment saying, I don't want to be a memory.
And family members say they couldn't remain silent despite death threats against them.
I have tried in so many ways to forgive, but I do not forgive you. Yasser Saeed, I do not forgive you for what you did to these two girls.
The Price of Honor will be shown next in L.A., then San Francisco, and hopefully New York before moving on to various film festivals. We are live in Dallas tonight. Jocelyn Lockwood, NBC5.
All right, Jocelyn, thank you.
Well, if you've had a chance to see Honor Diaries, this incredible documentary film which highlights, spotlights the treatment of women in Muslim-majority countries, if you enjoyed that film, I'm sure that this will be a powerful reminder of how prevalent honor killings are, even here in the United States. My new book, which I'm close to finishing, called Prisoner of Her Culture, reminds us of how honor killings can come right here to the United States. I'm really, really excited about this new book and to bring to light this issue, to bring awareness of the price of honor in films like this. My book is talking about the very same issue, but it's happening right here in the United States. And it's a wake-up call for us to do something about this situation. I want to bring us the trailer right now from the story of The Price of Honor. It's really the story of the Saeed sisters, Amina and Sarah. Let's listen right now on the cross in the desert.
We both felt like what we had was very much worth fighting for, and to her it was worth dying for.
Amina liked pink a lot. That was her signature color. If she could have put the world in pink, she would have done that.
Sarah was more of the tomboy, really reserved.
I don't think I ever saw Sarah without a smile on her face.
We were just attracted to each other. On every level, we were just connected. She was the kind of person I could have had the worst day within a minute of being around her, and nothing else mattered. She just had a very strong presence about her. All she really said was that her dad was strict. And the relationship progressed, she would tell me more and more horror stories about him, basically.
I was with my sister, and my mom called me and told me that Amina said that her dad had touched her. She was so afraid of Yasser, she would not even use a public telephone because she said he gets in everywhere, he knows everything.
Came into my room and she woke me up and she was like, I have to tell you something horrible.
How do you tell your child that the love of his life is no more?
I couldn't believe it. Like, it was just so surreal.
He clearly would have had to have a plan on how to get out of town.
How can you have that much blood on you and walk away from a crime scene without nobody seeing you? Somebody picked him up.
I don't think he ever left the States. I believe he's been here the whole time.
Well, now for the first time,
The FBI says this may have been an honor killing.
The shame that the family feels because of the woman's behavior causes them to kill her to restore the honor.
We had eye contact. He had a cap over his head, but he still had his mustache.
It's a film that I can't wait to see for the first time, and it's something that will probably make a difference in my life, as it has made the difference in so many lives. The story of Amina and Sarah is a tragedy that should never, ever have happened to begin with, and we must do everything we can to not let something that horrific happen again. I want to play in conclusion to this story about the price of honor. I want you to hear the dying words, the last words of Amina, dying in her father's taxicab. I want you to hear this on the cross in the desert.
There were chilling final words from a 17-year-old girl who was bleeding to death with her sister in a taxicab near Dallas today. Those words, "Oh my God, I'm dying." They are Amina and Sarah Saeed. They were both shot over and over and left to die outside Irving, Texas, in a hotel on New Year's Day. And now police are releasing tapes of the cell phone call they made to 911 as cops tried frantically to find them.
Irving 911, what is your emergency?
Oh my God, Johnny, this is 911, I'm dying!
What's going on, ma'am?
I'm dying, that's what's up.
Okay, let me transfer you. I'm gonna get fire department online, okay?
Well, police suspect the girl's father in the killing, the father who had apparently threatened one of the girls over her dating a non-Muslim boy.
Right now on The Cross in the Desert, I want to introduce a brand new segment, and I hope that you'll enjoy it. It's called The Sound Check. Really excited about this new segment on The Cross in the Desert called The Sound Check, spotlighting prominent Christian and non-Christian musicians and bands from all over the world. I felt the need to do this because I know here on The Cross in the Desert we deal with some very emotional, tense subjects. All of us are so driven by these events. We hear about them in the news every day, and I felt the necessity to kind of bring a breath of fresh air to the program and deal with more easier to understand and listenable subjects. And if you know anything about my passion, it's not just about writing. It's not just about radio, but it's also about music. I am a musician. I play guitar and write some original songs. Haven't yet really recorded them. I hope to feature them here with you someday. But I want to focus in today on a prominent musician who just recently passed. One of my favorite bands growing up when I was going to high school way back in 1974 was the band Yes. They had an incredible sound. They brought the music of the divine wherever they went. Just very talented musicians. Well, Chris Squire was the preeminent bass player and co-founder, and just recently died of leukemia at the age of 67. Like I mentioned, he's the co-founder and longtime bassist of Prague progressive rock icons like Yes, and the only member of the group to feature on every studio album, and he passed away just a month after revealing that he was suffering from a rare form of leukemia. Squire was 67 years old, and the current keyboarders for Yes, Jeff Downes, tweeted the news of his death this past weekend. He said, quote, "Utterly devastated beyond words to have to report the sad news of the passing of my dear friend, bandmate, and inspiration, Chris Squire." Yes confirmed Squire's death on their official Facebook page. They wrote, "It's with the heaviest of hearts, an unbearable sadness, that we must inform you of the passing of our dear friend and Yes co-founder, Chris Squire. Chris peacefully passed away last night in Phoenix, Arizona, in the arms of his loving wife, Scotty," the band wrote in a statement. Well, for the entirety of Yes's existence, I'm reading from the Rolling Stone right now, Chris was the band's linchpin, and in so many ways, the glues that held it together over all these years. Because of his phenomenal bass-playing prowess, Chris influenced countless bassists around the world, including many of today's well-known artists. Chris was also, a quote, "a fantastic songwriter, having written and co-written much of Yes's endearing music, as well as his solo album, Fish Out of Water." Yes formed in 1968 after singer Jan Anderson met self-taught bassist Squire at a London music industry bar. The pair were soon joined by guitarist Peter Banks, keyboardist Tony Kaye, and drummer Bill Buford. Yes released their self-titled debut in 1969. However, it wasn't until Steve Howe and Rick Wakeman replaced Banks and Kaye, respectively, that the progressive rock group really hit it big with 1971's The Yes album and Fragile. I just want to take a few minutes today on the soundcheck to feature the incredible talent of Chris Squire. I admire so many bass players in the world. One of them, of course, is Geddy Lee from Rush. Rush is on their real big last world tour. And then there was a bassist before Chris Squire, John Entwistle of The Who, just an incredible player as well. What I want to do is I want to feature on the soundcheck the bass playing of Chris Squire. This is from a live concert. It's a few minutes long, not too long. It's from a track called On the Silent Wings of Freedom, and this is Chris Squire on the soundcheck. Thank you. He had some amazing sounds from that guitar, and of course that was Chris Squire from Yes, from a few years ago on a world tour. I want to feature probably the signature based rhythm riffs that you're probably familiar with. This is really the song that really spotlighted who Chris Squire was, what he was capable of doing on the bass. And it's called The Fish. We're going to hear it right now on The Cross in the Desert. Fish, a signature song featuring Chris Squire, the amazing bass player for the rock group Yes. It was back in May that Squire revealed that he was recently diagnosed with acute leukemia, which would force him to miss the band's summer co-headlining tour with Toto. The absence marked the first time in the band's history that Yes performed without their longtime bassist. And Chris says this will be the first time since the band formed in 1968 that Yes will have performed live without me, Chris said in a statement. But the other guys and myself have agreed that Billy Sherwood will do an excellent job of covering my parts, and the show as a whole will deliver the same Yes experience that our fans have come to expect over the years. Chris Squire, the longtime bassist and co-founder of Yes, dead at the age of 67 from leukemia, Chris will be sadly missed as a rock icon, as a great musician all over the world. There are many, many songs by Yes I can play, and most of them are very long. But I thought of one song that featured Chris Squire on bass. It was actually one of their first songs. It's called A Time and a Word, and I want to play that today to our good musician friend as a tribute to him on the sound check. Here is Yes.
In the morning when you rise, do you open up your eyes, see what I see? Do you see of a time that will help us get it together again. Have you heard of the words that will stop us going?
Phenomenal music of the rock group Yes, featuring Chris Squire on bass, and I hope that you've enjoyed this new segment here on The Cross in the Desert. It's meant to just to pull you away from the emotional stories of the day, and give you just a little break from all of that, and to introduce to you some of my favorite groups and musicians all over the world. In the past, I've featured Kerry Livgren, who's a very strong Christian witness in the rock world. He was, of course, the former keyboardist and player and guitarist for the group Kansas. Also, Lacey Sturm from Flyleaf, and we'll be doing more of this. Let me know your thoughts on this. It's something different. I always like to hear what my listeners have to say, and it's a segment called The Soundcheck. Any kind of ideas you might have, I'm willing to hear what those ideas are. Well, it's been a while since we've heard from Paymene, my good Malaysian friend. I say she lives in Malaysia. She is an Iranian Christian refugee. She's been there a couple of years. And here recently, she's been dealing with some health issues. I know that you probably know we're writing a book together, and she's had some really I guess, some very painful back problems, getting some treatment for that. It's actually forced her to kind of lay down and sleep at times on her stomach because of these issues. So really be in prayer for Payman A as she recovers from these difficult days here. But as I mentioned, she's an Iranian Christian refugee. We're working on a book together. It's called Stories from Exile, and it features her life story. And so this is something I'm really, really looking forward to. And what I want to do today, I want to feature her latest story. I saw in the news a few days ago this deplorable situation in one of the prisons in Iran where they have actually cut off the water supply during Ramadan. And I said, Payman A, we got to write something about this. And I didn't know. She was actually going to remind me of a historical happening over 1,000 years ago that relates to why this prison facility has shut off the water. And so what I've always done in the past before, I want to share with you word for word what she writes. And Payman A has an interesting way of setting this story up. She's going to remind us of the history and then bring us to the present of what's going on in this prison. So I'm going to read this for you, Payman A's latest story. Many Shiite Muslims say, quote, hello to Hussein, but damn to Yazid, after they drink water. Over 1,400 years ago, the end of the first month of fall, Muharram, Ashura, the place, the Karbala, the weather was hot, open sunny area in Karbala in Iraq. The number of people, men, women, and children in Human Hussein's group is in doubt, but surely less than 200 people in total. The crime of the wrongdoers, Yazid did not support Imam Hussein to be the leader. And when you don't do that, you're waging war against Allah. So the context is the people in the Shiite section of Islam have said, you know, Hussein is our leader. And other Muslims were saying no, and one of them was Yazid. He's refusing to follow him. So here's how the story goes. Imam Hussein, the third Imam of the Shia group and the grandchild of Muhammad, who was killed in a war by Yazid over 1,400 years ago. What happened was Yazid surrounded the river and kept Imam Hussein and his soldiers from drinking. It's over 1,400 years ago that people are cursing Yazid for keeping his Muslim brothers and their families thirsty. Over 14 centuries, Shias have shed tears for their thirst. It was war. Yazid was a Muslim, but he was considered the enemy of God because of his wrongdoing. The war was considered the divine war between God and anti-God. Imam Hussein and his men were killed in that war, and the women and children were captured. They were winners because they fought against Allah's enemy. Yazid was very heartless by withholding water from the thirsty soldiers and their families. Now, fast forward 14 centuries later, June of this year, the beginning of the first month of summer, Ramadan, the place, the women's prison in Karachuk, southeast Tehran, Iran. It's referred to as Karachuk Death Camp. The weather, well, hot. It's a closed prison without any ventilation and air conditioners. The number of prisoners, over 1,200 women. The crime of wrongdoers. What was their crime? Why are they there? Different, small and big crimes, robbery, self-defense, murdering, converting from Islam, human rights activities, preaching different religions, defending prisoners as their lawyers, teaching the students of religious minorities who are not allowed to study due to their belief in faith, and political issues in private areas. Some of the prisoners might be considered unbelievers, but not all of them. Now, what's the story? It's fasting month. Ramazan, it's called Ramazan, I think, in Iran, Ramadan, Ramazan, the same. Prisoners are forced to fast. According to Sharia law, women must not fast and pray in specific days since they are considered unclean. Fasting and praying equals committing sins by an unclean woman. Still, the prison officials are using loudspeakers, threatening to flog the women prisoners if they are seen eating or drinking during the fasting hours of Ramadan. But this is not the main issue. The main issue is that the officials of the regime have cut off the water supply to the women's prison. The conditions are not bearable. It's overcrowded, hot weather, damp air, empty stomach, hygienic issues. All of these issues get more serious and worse, and breathing becomes harder due to the lack of water, along with health problems, emotional issues, depression, and 1,001 other problems. The dirty prison gets dirtier. The thirsty women get thirstier. The sick ones get sicker due to lack of fresh air in summer heat without water. Can any situation be worse? Yes, it can. The children living with their mothers behind the bars for their uncommitted crimes are watching, experiencing, and suffering from all these evil things. Imagine these children. Mothers are suffering from their children's situations more than thirst, hunger, and fear. The children, some of whom do not know how life is behind bars. Well, the children, as a result of this, will grow up and seek revenge. There is no water in prison for the women prisoners wearing long sleeves, scarves, and other pieces of Islamic clothes in hot summer to quench the thirst, to cool their hot body, to wash their face to avoid fainting, to wash their face after crying bitterly of disappointment and frustration. And the prisoners are always the losers, and the guards and the mullahs are always winners. And the guards and the president of the women's prisons break their fast with a big, delicious meal, a strong, sweet tea, a delicious drink, and as much water as they need. And they say, quote, hello to Hussein, but damn to Yazid. They curse Yazid, who is claimed to have had closed the water to his enemies, who wanted to kill him and shed his blood. And the president of the prison and guards curse Yazid, while a few feet away from them, behind bars, people desire one drop of water, the water that is cut off by them. And the president and guards repeat, damn Yazid, after drinking plenty of icy water. I hope that my friend Paymane has painted a picture of this unbearable suffering. You can imagine what it would be like to fast for nearly 14 hours a day without food and water until sunset. You can maybe picture that, but picture this prison filled with women with no access to water, and they will surely die. Please pray for these women who are suffering these unbearable conditions. What I want to do, since we're talking about Paymane's blogs and articles, I want to go to a related article that she wrote many months ago. I had asked Paymane, I said, Paymane, try to help my listeners understand a little bit about what it's like to be on death row in prison, scheduled to be hanged. And Paymane, in her beautiful talent, was able to come up with a story. It's a little bit long, but if you listen carefully, I think that she will paint a picture of what this suffering is like. I think the reason why she does this is to get the point across. We read these stories. We watch the videos. But I've asked Paymane to bring us right there and almost be there where they're suffering. And she did just that. This is her story called The Prisoner. And I want you to listen very carefully. Door, next time that you groan with your metal sound to open, you will open to my death, the death of my body. My soul was killed tonight. This dirty marriage killed me. Tonight that you opened for me to exit, I did not think that a nightmare worse than death was waiting for me. I did not know that I would be the most pitiful bride in the world. I wish you had never opened tonight, door. I wish you open again. I wish the long hours pass soon and my body be hanged, the dirt on my body and soul be cleansed. The first time when you opened, I don't know how many endless days ago, I thought this solitary cell would be the end of the world. It is, but not the very end. There was something worse than this solitary and death waiting for me. The dirty imposed so-called marriage is the most terrible thing in the world. Like all other things, like my confessions to the crimes I never committed, like being tortured to sign my confession, like breaking my hunger strike by feeding me from the content and toilet, by hanging me by my hands and beating in my stomach with their knees and boots, like telling lies to my family, being cruel to my family, like telling lies on TV, admitting how guilty I am while I am not, like confessing to having a relationship and communication with the people whom I've never seen and putting them in danger. The first time you opened to welcome me, I was really scared. Scared of you. Scared of death. Scared of the noose. Scared of the rope. Scared of everything. Scared of darkness. Scared of the grave. Now I'm numb. I have no feeling. No fear. Now I'm looking forward to death. I don't want this dirty life anymore. Full of offense. Full of humiliation. Full of beating. Full of nasty words, full of dirty hands, nasty touches, full of tiredness, darkness, solitary, enmity, threat. I don't want this dirty life anymore. I want this intolerable nightmare to stop. I tolerated all unbearable things. Now I want to sleep. Sleep. Since they have kept me hanging and slapped me when I fell asleep, I've wanted to sleep. I have dreamed of sleeping since they forced me to stand all night and poured water on me when I fell asleep. Last month they flogged my body. Tonight they flogged my soul. Tonight was extremely painful. Door, you have more empathy than these men. Your ears hear better than these men. I want to sleep. I prefer to talk to you. I don't want to talk to any human beings anymore. I don't want to hear any human voice anymore. I just want to rest. To sleep. No sound of the metal door. Anybody crying, any men sound, anybody humiliating. I just want to die. The things I went through were beyond my imaginations. I was a simple girl loving people, having a simple life. Suddenly, I was faced with courts, unfair judges, injustice. Nasty words I hear every day, nasty guys offending me every day. It's too much for me. The dirty hands touching me, beating me every day, the legs and knees hitting me are too much for me. I don't deserve that. I never thought I would be chained to the bed in the hospital like a dangerous murderer while I did not have enough energy even to speak. I never thought I would put the life of my family at risk. Now I just want to die. I love the time I won't breathe anymore. I love the time when God will hold me in his arms. But what if God punished me because of all the lies I've told, all the dirty confession, all the pain I've imposed on my family and others, to my mother? What is she doing now? They don't even allow me to see her, to say goodbye to her. God will punish me for all the pain I gave to my parents and my sister. Sorry, Mother. I wanted to defend humanity, but I was not even able to protect you. I gave all the pain of those humans to you, Mother. Mother, it's too dark here. I don't know what color the walls are. Father, your kind big hands always held me. Father, whatever you opened the door to enter home, you brought me the promise of warmth, joy, security, and happiness. During these years in jails, whenever a door opens, there is a message of unsafety, cruelty, and torturing waiting for me. There's the sound of footsteps. They're coming to take me. I don't want to die. I'm scared. I don't want this door to open. Prefer to stay in this darkness forever, but not die. I'm scared. Mother, help me. Father, where are you? Oh, I must be strong. Be strong, girl. You are strong. Be strong. Don't show your fear to these strangers. The women taking me to the noose are very scary. They are covering my eyes. No sympathy. I don't want your sympathy. But at least you can say something to help me. These women are the messengers of death. My shoulders are shaking. I don't want anyone to see me shaking. My legs, don't shake. It's just 1 minute, and then the suffering will be over, and then there will be no pain. I'm scared. Is this going to be painful? Is the rope painful? I don't want to die hanging. I don't want to struggle for breath. Mother, Father, I'm afraid. I have a strange feeling. My lips are shaking. It's better to pray. Let them see me praying, not shaking, not frightened. There is a voice. Two women are crying in the distance. Are they my mother and sister? Please don't cry. You make me more afraid. No. No, I hope they are outside. I hope they won't see me scared. I hope they won't see me hanging. I don't want them to see this. I don't want them to remember this. Oh, open my... No, no, don't open my eyes. I don't want to see the rope. Be strong. It will end soon. My neck hurts. My throat hurts. God, please kill me before the rope touches my neck. I'm climbing the steps. These must be the last steps. I cannot believe that. I wish this was a nightmare. I want to wake up. Wake up. Please wake up. God, I'm not guilty. I can't believe they're killing me. God, will you allow them to do that? This rope is too thick. Oh, God, I feel like I'm in hell. Stop it. Finish it soon. Is it possible they change their decision by a miracle and let me live? My mother is crying. My mother. Oh, God. I cannot breathe. It was written by my dear friend Payman A. to give you maybe a front row seat to what a hanging could be like. And as I'm reading this, I'm remembering the story I wrote for Rehana Jabari, book The Cross in the Desert. I don't know if I've shared this with you before, but I will share it now. One of the greatest privileges and honors I have is to write Rehana's life story. And her mother, Sholeh Pakravan, has given me permission to do that. And for the rest of the year, we'll be researching as Sholeh shares all of the important details with Payman A, and Payman A translates for me. One of the stories that Sholeh shared about Rehana was as a young girl, Rehana suffered from sore throats, and her mother would tell her just to gargle. And Rehana's answer to that was, Mom, I can't do that. I'm afraid of suffocating. Rehana, like the story we just read, faced the rope, faced her biggest fear last October. Can you imagine what was going through her mind as she looked at that rope and remembered that as a young girl, she was afraid of wearing anything tight around her neck or gargling when she had sore throats because she was afraid of suffocating? Well, the greatest privilege I've been given is to write, to paint a story of Rehana, not only about her suffering in prison, not only about the letters that she wrote while in prison, but also to put a face on this girl that maybe other Iranians don't know about. And she was a courageous girl. She stayed faithful to the end and refused to change her story that she was raped by Surbandi. And I intend to write her story. As I read Payman A's story today, I thought of Rehana. And one of the things I remember Sholeh sharing was that on the morning of her execution, she was completely at peace. She was driven to the particular prison for this execution. And Sholeh remembered how Rehana described to her through other witnesses that were there that she was not afraid. See, because Rehana would not do what they would try to do at the last minute and make her change her story. Rehana was a girl of great courage, a real symbol of Iranian women So I am looking forward to the next year of my life as I tell her story to you, the reader, and to you, the listener. And I haven't thought of a title of it yet, but right now I'm more interested in getting all of the necessary information and facts about Rahana's life from birth until death. And it is the book of my dreams to write. I want to leave us with a beautiful Psalm 139 from the Bible. We need a breath of fresh air. We need truth after listening to the horrible pain and suffering of Iranians. This is a psalm that talks about how God knows everything about us, and it should give us great comfort and great peace when we are faced with dark trials. I want to read Psalm 139 to you. O Lord, you have examined my heart, and you know everything about me. You know when I sit down or stand up. You know my thoughts, even when I'm far away. You see me when I travel, and when I rest at home, you know everything I do. You know what I'm going to say even before I say it, Lord. You go before me and follow me. You place your hand of blessing on my head. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too great for me to understand. I can never escape from your spirit. I can never get away from your presence. If I go up to heaven, you are there. If I go down to the grave, you are there. If I ride the wings of the morning, if I dwell by the farthest oceans, even there, your hand will guide me and your strength will support me. I could ask the darkness to hide me and the light around me to become night, but even in darkness, I cannot hide from you. To you, the night shines as bright as the day. Darkness and light are the same to you. You have made all the delicate inward parts of my body and knit me together in my mother's womb. Thank you for making me so wonderfully complex. Your workmanship is marvelous. How well I know it. You watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion, as I was woven together in the womb. You saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. How precious are your thoughts about me, O God. They cannot be numbered. I can't even count them. They outnumber the grains of sand. And when I wake up, you are still with me. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Point out anything in me that offends you, and lead me along the path of everlasting life. Anytime you are tempted to think God doesn't care and God doesn't see what's happening to you and God doesn't know the situation, anytime you are tempted, pick up Psalm 139. This amazing psalm is a portrait of God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. And we read how he knit us together in our mother's wombs. What a shame and a travesty for abortion doctors if they only knew what God had to say here about how we are fearfully and wonderfully made. So when you're tempted and you feel oppressed and you feel like fear is surrounding you and you feel like that God doesn't understand or God doesn't care, pick up Psalm 139. And let the words, the eternal, beautiful words of God, cleanse your soul, inform your mind, shape your thinking, and give you confidence and assurance that no matter where you go, even to the highest heaven or the deepest grave and darkness, that he is there with you to comfort you, to care for you, to deliver you. I want to thank every single person in the chat room today, Melissa, Mary, those I don't have names for that are guests. It is amazing. Thank you for giving your time and your busy life and to be a guest on The Cross in the Desert. You're always my guest. You're always welcome. I thank you so much for your support and prayers. It is a blessing to me. I will see you very soon again on the cross in the desert. Have yourself an incredible weekend. God bless you. And see you very, very soon again.
The curse.